The Swinging 30s, Radio, Part 2, Fibber McGee and Molly, Della Dallas, and The Edgar Bergen Show. Now, the Fibber McGee and Molly show premiered on NBC Radio April the 16th, 1935, featuring the radio show's most famous liar, later toned down to a grandiose dreamer, Fibber McGee and his best friend, the medium's most pompous windbag, Throckmorton P. Gildersleeve. And this hit show was no storyline situation. It arose when characters wandered into the McGee home at 79 Wistful Vista, Midwest USA. In a device that would shock audiences today, the announcer for Johnson Wax, the show's sponsor, doggedly visited the McGees to brag about the shine glow coat that his product had given the floor and Carnu had given to their automobile. The 30s gimmick was called the integrated commercial, and it created several strong sponsors' identification, if doing nothing for truth in advertising. The husband and wife team of Jim and Marianne Jordan played Fibber McGee and Molly, whose colorful friends included Mayor La Trivia and Mrs. Wearybottom. Radio listeners usually had to conjure up only one scene, the McGee's living room, where the sitcom's chatter and gossip took place, and the only door to open besides the front door was the one to the hall closet. The show's running joke. The closet was packed with typical family memorabilia, broken fans, never used skis, cord frayed guitars, and the clutter tumbled out in a clanking cascade familiar to all America. Bam, pow, thud, smash, crash, tinkle, ting. Gotta clean that hall closet one of these days, Fibber mused, and the listeners nodded, reminded of the clutter in their own closets. At least that's how the joke's long-running success was explained over the show's nearly two-decade run. If Fibber was a dreamer concocting the get-rich schemes, Molly was his anchor to reality, employing her Irish brogue laced with Gaelic wit to cajole him into abandoning nonsense notions. The Jordans had originally done a radio show called The Smith Family, a sort of all-white Amos and Andy. Then the series Smackouts, about a garrulous grocer who was always smack out of everything. But it was as Fibber McGee and Molly that the couple found an audience of millions, who became tongue-tied trying to imitate Fibber's latest stupefying alliteration as to his house guest, Dr. Gamble. Hiya, Aerosmith. Kick your case of corn cures into the corner and compose your corpulent corpus on a convenient camp chair. As the show's popularity increased, the alliterations, its oral trademark, and a national copycat craze grew mind-boggling. Punchbowl McGee, pronounced by the press and the public, the pugilist pixie of the pedigreed paperweight pugs, pummeling pudgy palooka, pulverizing proboscises, and paralyzing plug uglies. Fans visited the studio marveled at how Jim Jordan mastered the words in one take. Other Fibber utterances also became 30s catchphrases. Take a gander, kiddo. And what's cooking? During the 30s, approximately one-third of American households with radio followed the Fibber series. The Jordans, once starving vaudevillians earning $3,500 a week. They often played direct to depression audiences using the comic device of ego deflation. Fibber continually failed, was the butt of ridicule, was tipsy with delusions of grandiose, yet was loved throughout it all. The message to struggling husbands and fathers everywhere was simple. Bankruptcy, unemployment, and poverty need not cost you the love and respect of your family and friends. Jim Jordan believed the show helped families get through the Depression, and at the close of 1939, Broadcasty underscored that philosophy on the air, quote, "We are not unconscious of the fact that these are serious days. In bringing you a few smiles, we hope we are helping to lift your spirits a little bit. The only members of the animal kingdom who are able to laugh at human beings, so that let's stay human as long as we can. If, however, you didn't wish to laugh along with Amos and Andy and Fibber McGee and Molly, you could cry to the cruel misfortunes that continually befell them." Stella Dallas, premiered October 25, 1937. Sponsored by Phillips Milk of Magnesia. Stella Dallas had its theme song, How Can I Leave Thee, and opened with the announcer reminding listeners that they were about to hear the true life story of mother love and sacrifice, in which Stella Dallas saw her own beloved daughter Laurel marry into wealth and society, and realizing the differences in their tastes and worlds went out of Laurel's life. Stella had little education, gaucherly clipped her G's, as in lovin' and cryin', and with gusto spewed out double negatives like ain't none. Of the sudsy soaps, it was peerless. Frank Hummert, pioneer producer of several daytime soap operas and of Stella's, claimed the idea for such program was prompted by the kind of teary fiction American women were reading in books and magazines. Quote, it occurred to me that it might appeal to them in the form of a radio drama, end of quote. Such female-sided hits included Girl Alone, Valiant Lady, Manhattan Mother, and The Romance of Helen Trent. This last, the story that dared to ask, can a woman over 35 find romance? As Helen did indeed find for the next 27 years. By mid-decade, the new American art form soap opera was buzzing over the nation's airwaves. Stella Dallas had its origins in a turn-of-the-century novel by Olive Higgins Prouty. For daytime radio, the storyline became more tragic. Stella easily filled its misery-per-episode quota, as when Laurel's wealthy mother-in-law, Mrs. Groviser, threatens Stella over a misunderstanding. Laurel says, Mummy, I can't believe even Mrs. Groviser would be mean enough to send you to jail for stealing that Egyptian mummy. Notice that Stella was not actually gone out of Laurel's life. To clear up the mystery of the missing mummy, Stella, in the best tradition of the Iliad of a Greek hero, survives a desert storm, attacks by nomads, and hair-raising cruise through the Suez Canal in a submarine, all done with sound effects. First broadcast on October 25, 1937, the year of the long-running Guiding Light first aired, the soap remained popular until 1955, with one actress, Ann Elsner, playing the crude but sharp Stella. It was said that the show was designed originally for mothers who loved to feel miserable over the ingratitude of their children, and for years it played that way. When the hit ended, Ann Elsner opened the Stella Dallas restaurant in New Jersey, and for the next decade, at a diner's request, she'd bring the tough-talking, wronged mother out of the mothballs and to your table. Edgar Bergen and the Charlie McCarthy Show, NBC, premiered May the 9th, 1937. Now, radio being an oral medium, a most unlikely star would be a ventriloquist and his dummy, a voice-throwing act that depends on visual contact with the audience. Thus, it is all the more an achievement that the top-rated radio program in the country from 1937 till 1944, and never falling below number 7 over the next decade, featured the mild manner Edgar Bergen and his loud-mouthed Charlie McCarthy, the dummy, with his monocle, tuxedo, high-polished patent leathers. Millions of fans bought Charlie McCarthy puppets, alarm clocks, banks, and playing cards. And at Halloween, children masqueraded as the sarcastic Pipsqueak. Charlie, in many ways, became more famous than his Svengali. The show premiered in 1937, after Edgar Bergman had been told numerous times that a ventriloquist had no future in radio. Then came hilarious repartee between Bergen and Charlie as guests on Rudy Valley's The Royal Gelatin Hour. Suddenly, said Bergen, I was a hot number. Charlie McCarthy was perhaps the only ventriloquist dummy to be the toast of New York's Cafe Society. Invited to parties by Noel Coward and Alyssa Maxwell and asked to bring along Edgar Bergen. Few fans ever said, quote, let's listen to Edgar Bergen, end of quote. It was, let's listen to Charlie McCarthy. Why such popularity? Charlie was a blend of rascality, irreverence, and brashness. And Bergen believed that the dummy and the show were a hit because Charlie said things most people dared only to think. He flirted outrageously with Mae West and quarreled with W.C. Fields. Quote, Fields, tell me, Charlie, is it true your father was a gate-legged table? Charlie, if it is, your father was under it. Fields, why, you stunted spruce, I'll throw a Japanese beetle on you. Charles, why, you barfly, I'll stick a wick in your mouth and use you for an alcohol lamp. The show became a national pastime. One episode, though, precipitated a countrywide scandal. It involved the smoldering delivery of Mae West as Eve, cajoling Adam, Donna Meachie, in the Garden of Paradise. A skit tepid by today's standards. Congress demanded the FCC take punitive actions against NBC executives, proved the script were fired, and Mae West, no stranger to censorship, was in effect barred from radio for the next 3 decades. In the skit, Bored with Paradise, which West calls a dismal dump, she tempts the snake, who calls her swivel hips, to hand over the forbidden fruit. Then she persuades Adam to eat from her hand, quote, like women are going to feed men for the rest of time, end of quote. Adam, Eve, it's as if I see you for the first time. You're beautiful. Eve, and you fascinate me. Adam, your eyes. Eve, ah, tell me more. Adam, your lips, come closer. I want to... Eve, you want to what? Their lips met in a kiss, and then trumpets thundered. Adam, Eve, what was that? Eve, that was the original kiss. The religious uproar was immediate. The Roman Catholic groups urged a boycott of the sponsor, and the League of Decency expanded its index of forbidden books to include certain radio shows. NBC forbade even her name to be mentioned on the air. I only gave the lines my characteristic delivery, West explained. I am Mae West. The Charlie McCarthy Show ran for 15 years, and Edgar Bergen opened up an oral medium to voice-throwing acts, leading the way for teams like Paul Winchell and his dummy Jerry Mahoney. And then Edgar Bergen died in 1978, and Charlie McCarthy is propped up somewhere in the Smithsonian Institution. So, as always, the source for this is Panotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Her Most Cherished Obsessions by Charles Panotti. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, SummaHistorica.com or HistoryAccordingToBob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.